and I'm a friend of Julian's.
Yes.
And this is a slightly strange telephone call. I work at Rhodes University.
Yes.
And I was telling him what I was doing, which is writing a book about Ruth First and her journalism.
You spoke to my son about it.
That's right.
Darian Bernstein.
Yes, Darian. Why did I put Julian? Yes, Darian.
I don't know to what extent I can help you. I tell you the very little bit that I know of her. It's before the period that you're writing about, but you just might want to confirm. We were at school together, at Jewish government school.
That's what I want to know, because I'm not sure anybody...
We were both about 8 years old.
Do you remember that far back?
Not 8, 9, 10 years old. We were both about 10.
Yes.
I remember that her parents had put together a very good library for her. She put my nose out of joint. I was very good at English. And always top of the class, and then Ruth arrived and she took over. But anyway, she used to lend me books, and her parents had sort of got these books inscribed in proper library fashion, you know, the front piece and so on.
And that was at the age of?
10. We were both in standard 3 and 4, well, 9 and 10. We were in standard 3 and 4.
Yeah, and what sort of books was she reading? Or you reading? I mean, what were you reading about?
Oh, children's books at that
time. Books, yeah.
I wouldn't swear that that was the only stuff she was reading.
Yeah. Yeah.
She was very articulate even then.
Mm. How far? I'm interested in the school almost more than Ruth. I mean, the sort of... I went to look for it, actually, and it had disappeared. There was just a factory there.
Really?
In Doornfontein. Yeah, the building seems to have disappeared.
I'm amazed at that. It was there not so long ago, but of course it had changed its way. It was there. Mostly immigrant children, yeah. Portuguese were there.
So what when, school
when,
was it?
When we were there, it was a government school with mostly Jewish children in it, the children of immigrants. It was in English.
Yeah.
And it went up, I think, to standard 6. It was very lively. The German refugees had also just arrived in the 1930 crowd.
Yeah.
And were staying nearby and made their living by selling sweet drops, penny a packet to the kids. What more can I tell you?
And why was it Jewish?
Doornfontein was largely Jewish. Doornfontein was the place that all the immigrant Jews came to.
Yeah.
It was situated right in Doornfontein, near to the station.
And was it specially Jewish? In other words, today the thought of a specially Jewish school would be unusual.
No, not in that sense at all. There, you know, no religion was taught.
Yeah.
It was just called Jewish government school, the way the Jewish free school was called as in England.
Yeah.
And it was simply taught the same curriculum as everybody else, but because it was in a Jewish district, it was called a Jewish.
Yeah. Do you remember any special teachers or anything that's... I know it's digging far back, but...
Don't suppose they'd be alive anymore.
No, I'm sure, but I just wondered if there were any significant influences that might have been around. When we talk about 1935,
eh? Yes, there was Lippi Lipschitz. Just see if his names mean anything to you. Mrs. Wasserman, Walpi, also the Miss Walpi.
The name Walpi has gone through history quite considerably. I don't know whether that would have been.
It was a woman. I don't think it's those Walpies.
Yeah. Who was the principal, do you remember?
Isaacs, I think. Yes,
Isaacs. Yeah, don't remember her first name, do you?
No, there have to be records for this family.
Yes, but I'm trying. I'm having quite a lot of trouble finding them.
Yeah.
No, it's quite difficult.
You're sure that school no longer exists?
Well, you know, not having been there,
It was right down at the railway line.
Yes, I went to look where it should have been on the map. Mm. And it certainly, there was nothing that could have passed as a school. Now, it might have been dolled up or changed or turned to something.
No, it was a typical school of that period, you know, dark sort of browny red brick and little turret on top. I mean, you couldn't mistake
it.
It couldn't have been dolled up.
Yeah, I don't think it's there. I think it just isn't around anymore. How long were you and Ruth together in school? From what
Yeah, just a couple of years. In standard four, I left to go to boys' rooms. That's why I said to Darian, I don't think I'm going to be much use except to pin a pot in history. Yeah. I mean, I remember Dornfontein. I could describe the sort of life that went on in Dornfontein for
that would be very useful.
Shall I jot it down, perhaps? How urgent is all this?
I'm jotting it down.
You're jotting it down.
If I was right, I'm a journalist.
Yes, I also write. I'm a journalist.
No, really, where were you working? Or where are you working?
I don't work anymore. I was on, several papers. First of all, parochial ones, the Jewish Times. I edited the Zionist Record. I edited amateur photography. I wrote for what used to be my lady down here in the Cape long ago. And I wrote for the Sunday Chronicle when it existed. And otherwise, just freelance. I was on the Democrat for quite a few years. My husband and I were on that. Paul Sackstown, he took over. And that's about it.
It's interesting, just this is an aside. I started a little news journal in Grahamstown, and we call it the Democrat. And it had been running for about two or three editions when somebody said, hey, there was another Democrat somewhere. We started digging back and found that indeed in Cape Town, yes, there was.
Not in Cape Town.
Was it not in Cape Town?
No. It was seated in Johannesburg, but I'm sure that the records are all in the South African Library.
Yeah, well, that's where somebody dug it up, so I just presumed it was Cape Town. Yeah.
It was a fortnightly, might have become a monthly towards the end. It was quite a good little paper because we had excellent sources. PM, which was run by Marshall at the time, allowed us to lift everything from it. And early in the five-year plans of the Russians, we used to get enormous cables. They didn't care about money.
The Imprikor cables.
From Izvesta, not the sort of thing you pick up today. These cables were sort of printed out on a kind of telex.
Yeah.
And stuck onto paper, and they would be hundreds of pages long. They would send entire stories with every word, every za and a and comma written into it. But that didn't last too long.
When was this? Is this in the 1930s or
1940s?
1940s. Yeah. And what was the Democrats' focus? I mean, what is its political orientation, could I say?
Today we would call it anti-apartheid.
Yeah.
In those days it was, it was towards the end of the war, and it was for equality for blacks and whites.
Yeah.
Quite a lot of good names writing in it. Oliver Walker, do you come across him? Very sarcastic critic, but he used to be able to, put the situation of blacks and whites very clearly in. I'm sure you would have a black lift driver, but only whites could get in it. Cartoons would be made of that kind of thing. But if you come to Cape Town, I'm sure you could see whatever you want of the Democrat. I don't think it relates too much to Ruth, though.
No, she was on Fighting Talk and Guardian.
Right. I was on one of those. One of the Labour papers. I can't even remember its name now.
Yeah. I've got most of her writing, I think, by now. I've been collecting for many years, actually.
What we might be able to do is trace through some of my friends, people who were closer to her. If you've spoken to her brother, I suppose you must have.
Ronnie doesn't want to talk to anybody about the family. I've been working closely with Joe, but Ronnie's decided that side of his life is over. I think he was quite hard done by within the family. He was the odd one out. He became the capitalist when everybody else was communist.
Yeah.
And he got arrested in the early 60s, quite incorrectly, just for victimization. And I think that made him very kind of anti. But just to get back to Bronfontein for a moment, was it a residential area?
Yes, almost exclusively. There was a bakery there, known as Crystals at the time. And there were lots of little shops down the main street. Bait Street, I think it's called.
Yeah.
But otherwise it was residential, with quite a few synagogues sprinkled all over the place. And people coming into rather crowded conditions on the whole. For instance, my family came over. My father must have been 12 when he originally came to Dornfontein. And his mother, father and four children all stayed in one room in a boarding house.
Yeah.
That type of thing.
Yeah. Was it mainly Jewish?
Yes.
Lithuanian mainly?
Mainly Lithuanian Jews, but there was quite a sprinkling of German Jews who came in at that time.
Yeah.
They started coming in and, well, even when I was at school in 1932, they were already there.
Yeah.
So that's an earlier migration than the 1939 one.
Yeah.
And it extended quite a way down, because we lived somewhere near to Ellis Park. We had a factory in the backyard. There must have been a few little factory places in the backyard, but it was residential.
Yeah. Why did your parents come out from Lithuania? Because of the pogroms?
Yes, and for better working opportunities. My mother's parents came out long before this period. They came out in the 1890s.
Yeah, they
settled in the country. And I dare say, my father's parents had also come out in the 1890s, if he was 12 when they arrived.
Yes,
so they came from London,
yeah.
But probably before that from Lithuania. There were Lithuanian Jews. Lithuanian, Latvian?
Yes, yeah. Well, that's where Ruth's parents came from.
Latvia?
Lithuania.
Yes.
Her mother lived, I think her mother was actually born in Durnfontein, but her father came out. Did you ever go to her house? Were you that sort of friend?
No, we weren't that sort of friend. That's why I said I didn't think it could be too much use, except a place of a time for you, if you want a little bit of atmosphere at Durnfontein.
Yeah.
I can't think of the names that would help you. You know, people who went into politics afterwards.
Yeah. I heard, but it's hard to confirm, that Ruth had a thyroid problem, which made her quite plump. Does that ring a bell at all?
No, she wasn't plump when she was at school with me. She was quite a thin girl. That's why.
Yeah.
You want something more of that school and the teachers placed for you. My brother is 4 years older than I am, and he was there, so he might remember some names better. I'll talk to him.
Yeah.
Gosh, Darian did give me your phone number somewhere. I don't know where I've put it. Would you like to tell me?
Yes, it's 0461 23492.
23492.
Yeah.
All right. And you said your name was?
Don. Then it's PINNOCK.
Don Pinnock. Don, I'll have to stop talking to you now.
Sure, okay.
Do you want to talk again about Dornfontein? Do you want me to jot something down for you?
Well, I mean, I can't really ask you to jot things down for me. That's a bit cheeky. I'd love it if you did, but...
Let me have a bash. I've got a computer. Maybe I can...
That would be fantastic.
And then if I get too lazy about it, we'll just talk.
Yeah.
But I've been meaning to try and reconstruct some of the atmosphere of that place for a while. So if I talk to my brother first and get some of those names done for you, he may have one or two that made sense. I know somebody else who probably knows. Do you know Rosa Wolf?
No, it rings a bell.
Doesn't ring a bell. I'll give you the name and number, but you're not going to get her yet. You're going to have to wait some time for her to come back. Does that matter? She'll be back in about September, October.
Yeah.
All right. Rosa Wolf, Mrs. Rosa Wolf. And it's a Johannesburg number, 648-3968.
Yeah.
Now, she's also a little older than I am, so she'll remember more clearly. She was in with the whole crowd. She was with Congress of Democrats and knew a lot of the people that I knew. I'm almost certain she knew Ruth.
Yeah, that'd be useful. She's overseas at the moment.
She's overseas at the moment. She would have been at that same school that I was at, but a few years ahead of me. And again, you know, you might get some of the names of people who were there at the time who have some significance in that movement.
Oh, that's great. Okay. Well, has Darian gone back?
Yes, he's back in Paris now.
Yeah. He was interested in coming out here.
He's thinking about it. You know, once you get back to Europe, it doesn't look the same, unfortunately.
Yeah, we were really hoping he'd come and work at Rhodes.
Well, he's still thinking. He's been in Europe a long time.
Yeah, and Rhodes would really clip his wings. I mean, Grahamstown's so small. Yeah, I think it's too small for him somehow.
Well, it's near to other things, so he's got to think that through.
Yeah. All right, well, you have to go. Thanks for the time.
Thank you. I'll talk to you again.
Yeah.
I'll phone you when I've either jotted something down or decided that it's too much of a fact.
Okay.
And then we can talk again.
Right.
But meanwhile, I'll try and get hold of Bernard, that's my brother, and see if we can put together
something. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you.
Bye.
So that they will be books for future Khoisan to read. And these drawings are also messages to other shaman in other tribes that move across the plains of Africa. So we can see that the Khoisan were not a backward and stupid people, but had a powerful religion and a form of writing, perhaps many hundreds of years before we did. Music. The Khoisan have three kinds of musical instrument. INSTRUMENT. The first is their voice, and they have many beautiful songs about their life, lives, and their dreams. The second kind of instrument is the drum, or those kinds of instruments which make a noise when they are hit. The third kind of instrument comes from their bow, and the noise the stretched string makes when it is hit or plucked or harmonizes, HARMONISES, with the sounds of their voices. The main instrument that came from the bow is called the uhadi, U-H-A-D-I. This looks like a bow, but has half a calabash, C-A-L-A-B-A-S-H, tied to the bottom end of the bow. The string is tightened or loosened with a finger while it is being hit with a piece of grass or a small stick. You can hear this music on the tape. Music is very important to the Khoisan, because it is a way of talking to the spirit world and to the animals and mountains and trees which surrounded SURROUNDED them. All Khoisan can make music and learn to do this when they are still very young.
Nuance to her internal life.
Mm.
The tension, I guess.
I mean, writing demands attention, otherwise the motor's turned off.
Right.
And I need that tension and that polarity in her. I suppose that's what I'm looking
for. That's right.
I'm actually articulating that for the first time, but I see it's useful.
You see, that would be a fruitful way, that really going for the tension, because what you would be juxtaposing is her history and her heritage, which would be, in other words, you know, the kind of things that are there as deterministic influences in her life, versus experiences and forks in the road. and that's what you need much more of. Mm. You would say, given this tendency towards not being cared for, you know, she would have had to have some way of rising above it, or finding something else that was meaningful enough, or doing something with it. And it's those developmental sequences, those crucial moments in her life, which would give it meat.
Mm. She was very well cared for. She was cared for better than she cared for the children. That's definitely
right.
There's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
Her parents devoted far more time to her than she devoted to her kids.
Right. Okay.
But yeah,
you see, and that's what I've got. So that's the one scenario. Then the more you talk, you see, this is the danger of it, is then I think the kind of caricature profile of the one who has been elected, which is another thing in the whole kind of Jewish heritage, has to do with the syndrome of narcissism. Now, the one caricature I was going from what you were saying initially was this false self, real self dichotomy. Now, just as you talk again, the scenario of narcissism is that you are elected as the special one, you see, and in situations like that, your meaning you become incredibly grandiosely important in the scheme of things. In other words, you have to take the gap because no one else is taking the gap. The men are just flabby and fat, and no one else really understands or sees it the way you do it, so you have to carry the torch, because if you don't, no one else will. So that would be a grandiose caricature, you see. So yeah, there could be, you see, and then what you would look at is a book like The Drama of the Gifted Child by Alice Miller, who makes out a case for these children who get elected as the special one. And the burden that they have to then carry, the burden for their history and for giving meaning to their parents' life and to giving meaning to their parents' suffering and things like that. So that's another sort of scenario, but again, I'm afraid of caricature. Mm. In other words, I sort of, as you talk, I think of this syndrome, then I think of that syndrome, mm. and I don't have the meat to ground it.
Yeah, and in fact, there are bits of all of that.
Yeah, and how did she? That's the tension. How did she
put
them together somehow?
Well, there's a book.
Just for psychological analysis, isn't the highly disciplined writing, although it tells you something, but it's one wants to somehow balance it out from situations in which one sees her in a much more freely associative way.
Mm. Where I've got letters and notes to her editor and to friends.
Yeah, you might be able to do something.
They're always funny.
Maybe funny.
Mm. And she obviously has a great capacity for humour on paper, I'm not sure in person.
Yeah. See, that's very creative. I mean, and that's... yeah.
Is there?
You see, that gets away from, certainly takes it away from one of the scenarios that I was thinking of right in the beginning, which was a paranoid element. Often, with people from that background who are have to live in such hush-hush ways, there becomes a paranoid element. But in paranoia, there's no humor.
Mm.
So that would go against paranoia.
Well, the pressure there was, but yeah, humor as well.
Yeah.
And Joe, of course, was always funny.
So yeah.
She was living around somebody who made life easier.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Is there any analysis that you know of or books that analyze language, sort of psycholinguistic things.
There is. It's not something I've gone into, and I don't know much about it. But maybe you can find out. I'm trying to think of anyone who would know. But there is a whole field of psycholinguistics. I haven't found. I've looked at it a little bit. I haven't found it that yet helpful.
It worries me is to get into an entire.
Well, this is the problem.
To get one.
I'm just trying to think of any other analyses that I know of that just uses things like letters.
I can find that stuff.
Hmm?
I can track that stuff.
No. Nothing.
If I find hyper or hypothyroid,
yeah.
That could be quite an indication. Let me try that. What are the different spin-offs of each one of those? Hyper would be what?
I've forgotten which way around of it. One is an underactive thyroid, and one's an overactive thyroid. And you must just check it medically. I'm not sure which one gives rise to depression. Usually just doctors just tell me. But if she got the one that was due to depression, I'm just trying to think how that would...
Somebody who was a friend of hers when she was young said that she had a tendency to get thin and go very, very slowly, and she had to actually drive herself. She had to drive herself to leave, drive herself to get to school, really, really push.
Right. That would be a plausible link. In other words, that it would ask her even more to become become heroic in the way that. This may be this theme of heroism you could find in various aspects of her life, because she definitely, from what you've said, seems a heroic figure in many ways, and that would be a heroism against her body, heroism. None of her children ever developed any eating disorders or anorexia.
Not that I know of, unless that's what her youngest child is suffering from.
Yeah, you see, that would be very telling, you see, because with a certain kind of heroic, there's some interesting stuff on feminist literature on mothers that predispose their children to anorexia. And these are usually mothers who have a lot of conflict about their own feminine roles. They're usually mothers who feel that there must be, they must teach, especially their daughters, from very early on, not to give in to the kind of the softer sides of life, because so much heroism is needed, and they're an oppressed people, and therefore have to rise above that oppression and will need as much strength as they can get. And what this results in, often in the daughters, is a kind of a syndrome of, from very early on, learning to neglect their own internal messages and their own internal emotions and everything, and becoming very obsessed with control and remaining very, very independent, without really having the resources to do that, without really having the kind of the emotional backup to do that. And then what happens then in adolescence is that these children sort of feel the need to sort of remain in this terrible control, but don't know how to retain control in the complexity of their lives, so use their body as the stage on which the drama of control is somehow dramatized. It is interesting, but I don't know whether that relates. It would be very interesting if you, because that would be another link. If you found that one of her children had an eating disorder, or one of her children had problems at a certain stage, especially in adolescence, with control and trying to find learning to trying to kind of stay on top of things, then you could hypothesize that one thing about this mother is that Ruth, although was successful in herself in kind of being heroic, when she laid this on her children were diverted.
There's any literature on heroism, because it actually is, brings an interesting bill.
Yeah. You know, it's quite a strong theme in the Jungian literature. And that's something you could talk to Roger about, because he knows more about the Jungian literature than me. The classical one there is a book by Neumann, N-E-U-M-A-N-N, called the Great Mother. Yeah, and that really has to do with you know, how one slays the dragon, in other words, rises above one's context, rises above one's mother to make one's own mark in the world, and that becomes a heroic quest to somehow.
That sounds spot on.
Sorry?
I think I didn't get access to it, but that's right.
Yeah, so you could go into that.
Let me see if it's in here. It's a nice one.
He talked about it as a very masculine quality, so that, for example, a Jungian analysis would take an interesting line, depending how much you go with kind of Jungian psychology. That could be a whole other thing. It would look at how Ruth First's mother embodied masculine qualities, her father embodied feminine qualities, and how that was duplicated in Ruth and her husband. And her husband, you know, your description of a chubby, kind of easygoing, quite a receptive man, sort of embodies feminine qualities, and the wife embodied more masculine qualities. It's just an interesting kind of reversal.
It is true.
Yeah.
In both cases.
And, you know, one could think a little bit more about that, perhaps.
Okay, I don't want to take too much of your time.
Yeah.
That's great.
Okay, I'm sorry I couldn't help you.
And there were part of the Jewish community that was intensely political and intensely.
Yeah.
I think they substituted what was Jewish, essentially, for what was communist. But I don't think there was much difference between those two.
Right.
It was very much a family affair, it was a diaspora, again, within a larger society. And the paradise had not yet come, you know.
Yeah.
Jerusalem or Russia.
Right. Yeah. And when Ruth's mother, there's no evidence or any kind of indications of how she would how she would respond under stress. In other words, any symptoms or any
Ruth.
Ruth's mother. Any physical or psychological symptoms that she had done, was she prone to anxiety or depression or to any kind of vulnerability?
She appeared to have no vulnerabilities. I'm sure she did.
Okay.
But she was so smooth glass ball exterior.
Right.
She seemed to cope with absolutely everything. She coped with the family. She even coped with bringing up these kids.
Right.
I don't know whether she got depressed or down.
Right.
I think she got angry. I think she had a power over time.
Yeah.
It's an expression of emotional power.
Right. And Ruth was one of a family of how many?
Two.
The other being a daughter as well.
No, the other being a younger brother.
And that's the one who became very,
very political.
Very political.
So outside the family was he that he didn't even know when he walked into the house when Ruth was getting married, and there was a marriage set party going on.
Yeah.
And he was totally shocked. What's going on?
Right.
So he was feeling right.
And Ruth was brought up by her parents, but they were just so that they were physically available.
Yeah.
That they were there physically, but not.
They were very proud of her. She embodied everything they ever wanted in the kids. Not the brother. The brother, he was an outsider.
Yeah.
She became the communist that they hoped she would become.
Yeah.
The leader, the journalist.
Yeah.
So she fulfilled their wishes.
Yeah.
I think that's part of the strength.
Right.
You had to keep that up.
Yeah. That's right.
But whereas her brother probably had the correct reaction of bailing out completely and doing something, she stayed within the expectations.
Yeah. Right.
She later was always kicked out of the party often because she was uncontested and didn't follow the party on purpose in the later years, which was mature as well.
Mm. And what sort of mother was she?
Distinct. I think she was there physically, not often, but she was often actually out and she'd work at weekends. She was often too busy to be emotionally available.
Mm.
And I think too unsure of her own emotions in a tight corner to be too useful.
Somehow. How did that come out? I mean, have you got any stories or anything about that side of her?
I had long talks to Gillian, who I know quite well, the middle daughter.
Yeah.
He retains an anger.
Yeah.
And says that her mother was not there emotionally for her. She'd go to her crying because of something. And her mother would just say, cope, cope. This is, you know, there are lots of black people out there in a much worse position than you. You know, what's this nonsense?
Yeah.
You don't have a right to be sad, angry, whatever.
Yeah.
And I think that the distancing, she distanced her from the daughters.
Right.
The struggle was in the front and the daughters were behind. She once told a friend of hers, or maybe she said, Martin, a good friend told me, that she had said, you know, she loves her daughters very much, but the struggle is the most important thing in her life, and there are millions of people out there who are starving and dying and are oppressed, and those are the people she's fighting for, and through them, for her daughters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's doing her daughters a favor in the long term.
Yeah.
But by way of excusing the fact that she's not doing anything for her daughters in the short term.
Mm-hmm. And feminist values?
She wrote a book which is a biography of Olive Schreiner in the later years with somebody, and only then, many years later, in the 70s, she became feminist.
Mm-hmm.
She read a lot of feminism and talked about feminists as well.
Mm-hmm.
In the period I'm looking at, 40s and 50s, she didn't. Women had to compete with men. She competed with men and beat them hands down. She never saw the need to take up any kind of ideas that were different to the values of the world she knew.
Right.
She had her hands full opposing the whole apartheid capitalist structure,
right.
But opposing the sexist stereotype. She was just 15.
Yeah. Yeah. And what? Any psychological symptoms at any stage in her life? Did she get depressed?
I sense that she did, although very few people saw it. I think her daughter's book indicates that she had major depression. Not knowing whether she was doing the right thing, whether she was being useful in the world, being a good mother. Her eldest daughter shouted her way into his attention. Very aggressive, and I think that caused a lot of friction and Ruth was confronted. That's amazing.
So that's kind of self-doubting. Was it only prevalent in later years?
Yeah.
It didn't really happen much earlier.
Yeah.
So the depression seemed to come later.
Mm. Mm-hmm. But then, I mean, she got immensely depressed in detention to the point of suicide.
Mm.
She wrote a book on her detention. It was the only bit of emotional writing that I've ever seen anywhere, and I've got mountains of her writing.
Yeah.
It was just a sort of window that opened, almost as if to get it out of her system.
Right.
Within a book, in a very structured way again.
Yeah.
Chapter closes and what she wrote.
And what came out in those emotional kind of moments? Was it anger?
A lot of anger for what was being done to other people. Mm-hmm. And a feeling of great helplessness as one gets in detention. Yes, that's the key. Feeling of lack of privacy and feeling very insignificant and getting very anxious about using a shower or a toilet. Just feeling that the whole structure is falling apart and feeling very frightened.
Yeah.
That's more is that.
Yeah.
As she gets.
Mm.
So I suppose what I'm asking is, what is the process by which one starts exploring a person when you only have the exterior?
You see, that's what's so difficult. Because in a kind of psychological assessment of the person, what you first get is you try to get a profile of first of all what recurrent symptoms or worries or concerns they have. Okay, so that's sort of about the internal stuff. Okay, then you use the backup material which you've given me about the mother and the father and the history and the grandparents and where they come from, as a secondary thing to kind of try to put it together with how it would help you understand what the primary thing is, which is the nature of the problem, the nature of the psychological state. Okay. The third thing that you do is you actually have an interview with a person and do what's called a mental state examination. And you ask very specific questions about things which you haven't been able to, you know, like have you ever felt at times in your life that you were very on your own? And you go through a whole list of things to try and get some kind of psychological profile. And then the other backup thing which is very helpful usually are dreams, which gets you into the internal state of the person. Yeah. Now, what you've got most of is what I would call the family history and events about the family history. But what we have very little about, which is crucial to the whole process, is we have to reconstruct the meaning of it rather than get a real kind of sense, you know, or just from very thin evidence. We just have anecdotal kind of things about what the meaning of it must have been. So one can only kind of one can only wonder, you know, it's not very tight to try and get a good psychological evaluation of it. You know, we lack the internal stuff, the diaries and the motivations, and, you know, the internal working. How often did she get depressed? How often did she get anxious? Did she ever get paranoid? Things like that. So, the most that I've got from what you're saying so far is this incredible split between the political realm in the personal realm, you know, where there's a kind of almost a sacrifice of the personal to the political. But you get that in most highly political figures. You know, it's not something that helps us look at her in a very nuanced or refined way. And so the picture I'm getting is of a person who isn't really well grounded at all, in a sense of personal self-esteem very much at all. You know, she was kind of elected by her parents to be this ideal figure, and she took this ideal image and she sort of wove herself around this ideal image, not giving much place for her actual self. So I could refer you to some literature on that, but basically what it's about, it's about a split between what would be called a false self and a real self. whereby she would have to, she would feel puffed up and coping within a particular realm of instrumentality, that as soon as she was asked to just respond in less structured ways, in very kind of less collective ways, just as a person drawing on her just her natural sense of being just a human person with very human qualities, she would kind of not be able to cope very well with that. So that's all I've got so far from
a friend. Some friends said she was very warm and loving when she trusted them and they trusted her, when once she felt secure with the creature.
Yeah. You see, this is the danger about what we've got about this external, is a caricature. So you see, the whole perspective that I'm bringing is kind of a knowledge and an understanding of general diagnostic categories and general psychological types. And because of the absence of the inner world and her there, the danger would be to caricature her. You see, and so that's what I've done. I sort of caricatured her. In other words, the fact that she was able to kind of be very warm you know, wouldn't fit in with this picture. Because that kind of picture of the split between the false self and the real self gives rise to a profile in which the person is motivated towards caring for others not out of real concern, but out of a kind of a vicarious attempt to heal their family and to heal themselves, and a less kind of authentic form of concern. But if she was truly warm and truly outgoing and whatever, then she obviously felt that at some stage she had got enough, because the picture that you had drawn from her history is of somebody who was emotionally deprived and therefore tried to compensate by living up to this ideal, because she didn't expect just to get enough emotional nourishment for who she was as she was. There she would have to live up to this ideal. But then in that kind of caricature picture, you wouldn't really have the real capacity for concern. So that's the danger, you see.
Then I've got some love poems that were written to her by somebody who must have been a lover.
Yeah.
And they speak of sort of passionate, her being absolutely passionate and sensual. And whether they're just his imagination or whether they're real, it's certainly interesting poems.
Yeah.
They seem to indicate a sign of her that is quite hot-blooded and not a mere intellectual.
You see, that's where we would need more information, is whether how consistent that was, or whether these were just the return of the repressed, whether it was just like the return in odd moments where she would, in the odd affair, have to find outlets for her own kind of energy. And what would be really interesting then is whether the relationships were very sexualized, and in other words, were they just intense, passionate moments of kind of stress release, or were they more sort of consistent attempts at establishing a relationship for its own sake, because of the meaning of that relationship, that kind of thing. And that's what's so hard.
So lovers, some of you might know, I'm not prepared to talk about that. I'm just joking around.
See, it's that kind of information that would make the difference between you caricaturing her and for us to get some kind of real refinement in this analysis. You know, that's the tricky thing in this whole thing, is just from what you've told me, we're more likely to get a caricature.
But I suppose what I need is two things. One is, if I can find the key thing which drives that, or several key issues.
Right.
It's easy to write the thing outwards.
Yeah.
And then the history.
That's it. And then you draw that. That's it. Yeah.
But in the absence of that,
yeah,
it's
missing
all over the place. So
yeah.
The second question then has to be, well, given what I have.
Yeah.
And given what I can't get, like dreams and so, where does one go to find, or is it actually impossible to find those things which make her go?
You see, it is, it's very difficult because if we were to try